Welcome to STEAM Powered, where I have conversations with women in STEAM to learn a little bit about what they do and who they are. I'm your host, Michelle Ong. My guest today is Kyra Malay. Kyra is a cybersecurity GRC specialist who takes a pragmatic approach to governance, risk, and compliance in cybersecurity and works with organizations in various sectors on their path to security maturity. Join us as we talk about Kyra's indirect journey to cybersecurity and what cybersecurity involves, from policy to supply chain security and social engineering. Good morning, Kyra. Thank you so much for joining me on STEAM Powered. It's wonderful to have you speaking with me today about all the stuff that you're doing in cybersecurity.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Excellent. Okay, so we'll get right into it. So you started out in social sciences, studying politics and international relations before you shifted into tech. But what motivated you to pursue social sciences?
It was actually something that I always had a bit of an interest in. You know, when I was a kid, I was always reading history books and stuff instead of, you know, the more normal kid stuff. When I was in high school, I did extra history classes as electives because I was a bit of a nerd. So I was kind of deep into the ancient Greek and the Roman and Egyptian history and all of that. And then I also did some modern history and political studies and that kind of thing. So when I was heading into university, I had like a vague idea that I wanted to be a diplomat, but it wasn't really set in stone. I was just like, this is the thing that I want to study. I wanted to do politics and international relations, and I did a second major in history as well. And that was just kind of what I wanted to read about and what I wanted to think about. So that's why I went into it. I wasn't really planning a specific career path beyond that. And it was just stuff that I really enjoyed kind of digging into and pulling things apart.
That's very, very cool. So, you know, did you have an idea about how you were going to become a diplomat, or was that just...
Not a very structured idea. I think I was like, I'll just study this and then I'll apply to some grad programs in Canberra, and obviously they'll take me because I'm fantastic. spoiler, they didn't take me because I only had an undergrad degree and I didn't speak a second language, which is probably something I thought should have thought about. So I ended up doing a lot of different things. I worked in hospitality all through university to support myself. And then I kind of had a choice between doing further studies. I was looking at doing a master's or a PhD, but it was kind of at the point where I was like, I can't really afford to keep studying. So I went into a full-time job in hospitality, managing cafes after university. And from there, I ended up pivoting into tech. So a bit of a curly journey.
Yeah, that's cool. That is a curly journey. But so what made you kind of decide that tech was where you wanted to be?
I was actually looking to get out of hospitality because I didn't want to work weekends anymore. And I was really tired of being on my feet for about 12 hours a day. So I ended up talking to some people that I knew who were working at a local internet service provider here in Perth. And they were looking to add people to their tech support teams who had quite good communication and customer service skills, and they were willing to teach the tech side of things. And that seemed like a pretty good deal to me because I'd been working with people for quite a while. I was pretty good at handling complaints and talking to customers and all that kind of thing. So I applied and they ended up getting me into one of their intakes, and I learned all the, you know, turning it off and turning it back on again side of things while being able to kind of hold a conversation with customers on the phone. So that was kind of where I first started diving into the tech side of things.
So from there, getting into cybersecurity. So what's that path like?
Again, it was a bit of a happy accident, actually. So I was working for the internet service provider. I moved through a bunch of different specialized teams. So I did some level 2 support in a few different technologies. I ended up handling escalated customer complaints for about 9 months, which was not a fun time. And after 9 months, I was like, I need to do something different. So I moved into our actual retail store and I was helping to manage that. And at the same time that I was doing that, we had a new cybersecurity manager come on board who was working towards PCI DSS compliance, so the payment card industry standards. And he needed us to make some changes in how we had our retail store set up. he evidently had approached the manager of the actual store a few times and not gotten much of a response. So he ended up coming to me as the second in command and was like, oh, I need to make some changes to make us in alignment with the standard. Can you help? And I was like, sure, what do you need me to do? And he sent me the 4 or 5 requirements from the standard. And a week later, I came back to him and I was like, cool, here's how we have introduced new processes to make sure we're in alignment with it. This is what it's going to look like ongoing. We'll have these regular checks, all sorted out. Let's go. And cool. He was like, what the hell? This took a week. Like, why didn't I come to you 3 months ago? I was like, I don't know. A couple of months down the track when he was actually looking to expand his team, so we could do more work, in terms of aligning with standards like ISO 27001, I was one of the people that kind of put my hand up because I don't know if people who haven't worked in call centers probably don't know this, but everyone's goal is to get out of the call center to get into one of the corporate roles. So I was like, yeah, cool, I'll do that. And I actually looked at the job description and I wasn't going to apply because I was like, I can't do this. I'm not technical enough. I'm not going to be able to do the role. And one of my coworkers at the time pulled me up and said, hey, stop. Like, there's one thing on this list that you don't know how to do, which is scanning for security vulnerabilities. And he's like, but everything else that's on there, you can do, you've been doing, and you can do it. So I ended up putting in my application about an hour before they closed on the last day. And because, you know, I'd worked with the security manager before, and he knew the kind of things that I could do, he ended up giving me the role. And that was where I ended up in cybersecurity. It was not, not a planned career progression. And I honestly hadn't even known that it existed as a thing before that. I dabbled in a lot of regulatory stuff and privacy areas. But this was kind of my first foray into actual cybersecurity. So yeah, that was it to me, it was kind of a lesson in how helping people and, you know, just trying to do what needs to be done as part of your role can actually help you progress. Because if I hadn't picked up that thing from our cybersecurity manager and said, yeah, I can do that and let's get on with it, then I probably wouldn't have ended up in that role.
Yeah. And that's amazing. And, you know, people do forget that a lot of the stuff to do with cybersecurity is about compliance at so many different levels. And, you know, it's not actually an unnatural progression to go from regulatory and compliance into cybersecurity, because it's still two sides of the same coin. You're just heading more to the technical side of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's some specific, you know, regulatory and compliance requirements for cybersecurity. You know, we have our own standards that we need to implement. For me, I think the most important part with those kinds of compliance and regulatory activities is to actually make sure you're approaching them in a pragmatic way. I'm not a big fan of kind of the checkbox approach where, you know, the standard says you do XYZ, so we're going to do XYZ to the absolute letter, because that might not actually make sense for your business. You know, I've seen a lot of organizations who, you know, some of the controls in ISO 27001, the standard for an information security management system, specify that you should have, you know, a secure development lifecycle. And then organizations who don't actually do any in-house development will then sit down and write a standard of how to do secure development when they could actually just go, this doesn't actually apply to us, so we're not going to do it. Like,
yeah.
Actually kind of putting that lens over and going, well, what do we as a business do and what's actually going to make the most impact? You know, writing a policy that you don't need, that no one's going to read, that's just going to sit there, to me doesn't really accomplish anything.
No, exactly. And you know, a lot of people forget that, because as soon as anyone says process, it's like, oh, right, so we need to follow everything to the letter. It's like, yeah, but context.
Yeah, and part of that is, you know, you shouldn't write a process and then roll it out and expect people to follow it. You should look at what people are actually doing and use that to inform the process. And, you know, you can make tweaks because, you know, there might be some things that people should be doing that they're not. But if you've got too big of a gap between what your process says and what your people are doing, there's probably an issue with the process as well as what people are doing. It's not just the people who are wrong.
Exactly. So it's all about the change management aspect as well, because, you know, you're changing the way that people do things, you're changing the way that they approach what they're doing.
Yeah, and the way that's communicated, I think, is really important. It's one of the things that I've always been quite passionate about in my roles is, you know, kind of taking it to the people. You know, I don't want to be sitting up in some ivory tower telling people what to do so that they can be more secure, because they know their jobs better than I do most of the time. And I'd rather work with them to work out what they're doing, why they're doing it that way. Are there improvements that we can make, or is there potentially, you know, an issue with the process or the policy, and maybe we should put that risk lens over it and go, well, is this actually that big of a deal? And if it is, obviously make changes. If it's not and you're happy for things to keep going the way that they are, then adjust your policy, adjust your process. Don't just, you know, take out the stick and start whacking people. It's about kind of taking them on the journey rather than dictating what other people should be doing.
Exactly. That's, yeah, exactly how you're supposed to handle all process management.
Well, in an ideal world, yeah.
In an ideal world. So what does governance, risk, and compliance involve in the space that you're in?
So in cybersecurity, it covers a lot of different things. So I guess it's interesting because people think of cybersecurity and they kind of immediately go to the hackers. And, you know, we would normally, you know, on the good side, we call them penetration testers. And there are a lot of them and they do a lot of valuable work. But there's so much more going on in cybersecurity than just the penetration testers. So there's also, you know, a lot of actual defense work going on, sysadmins, network admins who are kind of on the front lines. We've got incident response and a whole plethora of other things. And also my area, which is governance, risk, and compliance. So we're usually the people who are working, so the governance is a lot of the policy and process work. So we'll be looking at defining information security policies. There's usually also data classification, because obviously you can't protect things if you don't actually know the level of value that they have and therefore how much protection that they need. And, you know, kind of defining a lot of those policies and processes and then doing the continuous improvement piece. So once we've defined it, actually rolling out those policies and processes to people, making sure they're implemented properly, and then doing a review to make sure they are updated as you go along, as things change, as technology changes. Risk is my personal favorite section. So risk management is more where we look at threat modeling and we actually start looking at what you actually need to be concerned about. Like, how do you prioritize the security work that you need to do, and how do you kind of put that into a to-do list and track it? So risk is all about looking at everything that can go wrong, working out how likely is it to go wrong, what's actually going to happen if it does go wrong, and then using all that information to come up with plans so that you can fix those risks, you can avoid them completely by stopping doing the thing that would lead to that. You can outsource that risk to someone else. You know, you can take your, you know, internal service desk and outsource it to someone else, and then they're carrying the risk rather than you are. Or you can choose to accept the risk, which is generally not the best thing that we want to hear. Someone going, that's fine, we'll just go with it. But well, it's also exactly. But the thing to remember is that, you know, organizations have a business to run. They're not just there to do security work 24/7. You know, there needs to be a particular point where maybe something is too expensive and it's not actually worth the problem. It's the whole question of, you know, putting a $10 lock on a $5 bike. Is it actually making sense or not? And that's the risk lens, which is why I really like it. It's got more of those gray areas where you can actually start asking pointy questions about why you want to do something and why is it a concern. And then we have the compliance portion, which is usually based around particular standards or regulatory requirements. There's a lot of legal feed into that. So, you know, in Australia, we have the Privacy Act. In, you know, Europe, there's GDPR. All of those kinds of things will feed into the compliance side of things. So whichever standard you choose, you have to actually make sure you're meeting all of those requirements. Usually you'll be the one doing internal audits, and then also you have your external audits where an independent third party will come in and go through everything and check to make sure that you're actually doing the things that you say that you're doing. So those are kind of the three areas, you know, we refer to it as GRC, governance, risk and compliance in cybersecurity. And a lot of these areas, they do have similar areas in like other parts of the business. So a lot of organizations will have an overarching risk team if they're a big enough organization. And they'll look at all business risks, as well as, you know, environmental risks and all of those kinds of things. Whereas we tend to specialize specifically into the cybersecurity stuff. You know, the concepts are the same, but we're looking at a subset of everything, and getting a little bit more specialized in terms of, you know, what those threats look like and what the actual remediations would be to fix them.
That's cool. So I've always wondered this, with the outsourcing of risk, especially when people now talk about how businesses and how they have to take responsibility for every step of the supply chain. But when you're starting to have to do things like outsourcing your risk or delegating some of that to other areas, and the onus is on us to ensure that they will comply, but where does that line kind of come in for the, I guess, the responsibility to the business owner?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question. And supply chain security, I mean, it's a big thing at the moment because, you know, there's been a lot of quite high profile compromises of, you know, tool providers, SolarWinds being probably the most most famous one, which kind of scared the pants off a lot of people. And supply chain security is not an easy thing to do because, you know, when you're talking about a supply chain, you really only have a relationship with like one chain link forward and one chain link back. But all of your providers and all of your customers have their own suppliers and providers and customers as well. And that can have an impact on you. So usually a lot of the time this will be addressed through contracts. So you'll have contractual clauses that require your suppliers to do due diligence on their suppliers. And you require them to provide you with documentation on an annual basis to show that they're doing that and to show that they're doing all of their cybersecurity stuff that they should be as well. The tricky part of that is, you know, you then have to make sure you're actually enforcing it, which I think is where a lot of people actually fall down because they sign the contract, off they go, and they never really think about it again. So supply chain security is one of those really tricky areas where there's a lot going on. And, you know, in previous roles, I've had to do risk assessments on, you know, our provider is providing us with this service. They've outsourced part of that to someone else. Yep. So you're actually, it's not even third party risk. You're looking at fourth or fifth party risk.
Yeah.
And the tricky part is I can't really approach that supplier's supplier and go, hey, give me all of your security documentation because
the relationship's not with,
there's no relationship. So it does get very tricky, and mostly it's making sure you have those relationships with your own suppliers and making sure that you know that they're doing it right. And then it's kind of a ripple effect. If everyone's doing it for all of their suppliers and all of their customers, hopefully everyone ends up getting covered. It's not always the case. And a lot of the time internally, you can have, you know, some other mitigating controls in place to, you know, reduce the impact if there was, you know, one of your suppliers getting compromised. So there's kind of that twofold way to manage it is, you know, internally have some stuff in place that will kind of cover you if something goes wrong with that supplier, and then make sure you're working with that supplier so that, you know that they're doing the right thing as best they can. And the thing to remember is, you know, an organization or a supplier or whatever getting compromised, it doesn't mean that they were doing the wrong thing. It could just mean that, you know, something got missed, or the particular threat actor or the attacker or whatever you want to call them just had more capacity. And, you know, I mean, we often say in cybersecurity, if there's a nation state actor that wants to compromise you, they pretty much will, because they have the time and the resources to sit there and just find like one tiny chink in the armor. So really most of us are just trying not to be the low hanging fruit. We just want to make it that little bit more inconvenient for an attacker to compromise you and just hope that they go for someone else. But you know, if someone has that much time and money and energy, they probably are going to compromise you. And that's just kind of a fact of life. We call it in cybersecurity assume breach. Basically, everyone should assume that they've been breached at some point and you should act accordingly. So it's probably a little bit of a negative worldview, but, you know, for a lot of us, it just kind of means, you know, we just have to keep fighting the good fight day and night. And, you know, we may end up on the losing side at some point, and all we can do is like the best that we can do.
Yeah. Well, it's like that expression, right? The bumper sticker, trust in the universe, but lock your car.
Exactly. That's basically what we're doing.
Yep.
Distrusting the universe, I think, but locking the car anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that applies in so many other aspects of, you know, just general living in society. But you know, it's not just big businesses. It's talking about our own personal security, our own personal electronics and devices and stuff like that, and just being aware that we are vulnerable in so many different ways. And just trying not to be the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like some of the really simple stuff, you know, like I think, I don't quote me on the exact statistics, but I think Microsoft did a study and they found that, you know, like 94% or something, like a very high percentage of account compromises were prevented by multi-factor authentication. Yeah. So just enabling that one thing on your personal device can put you so far ahead of the pack in terms of getting compromised that, you know, it is a little bit inconvenient. I often will get annoyed when I'm very easily distracted. So I'll put my phone in a separate room.
Yep.
And I'll sit down on my laptop and I'll be like, I'm going to do some work. And then I go to log into something and it goes, approve the login on your device. And I'm like, oh, now I have to go get my phone. Yeah. But that, you know, 5 seconds of inconvenience to get up and go get it from the other room is way less effort than if my account actually got compromised and then I had to deal with being locked out and my account being used to do goodness knows what.
Exactly.
So, you know, a very small inconvenience for a very big gain in terms of, you know, online safety and privacy. So it's kind of the way I approach that is, you know, I think a lot of cybersecurity people will sit here and say, you should have multi-factor authentication on everything. You should have a password manager. You should do this. You should do that. And no one really acknowledges the fact that, yeah, sometimes it sucks a little bit, but it's so much better than the alternative. Like, let's just acknowledge that cybersecurity isn't always easy and it isn't always convenient. There's definitely ways that we can do better with those kinds of things, but, you know, a little bit of inconvenience now is probably better than a lot of inconvenience down the track. So Absolutely. That's kind of how I balance it.
Yeah. And I mean, we've all probably known at least a couple of people who have had security breaches and it's just completely turned their life upside down for weeks, if not months. And it's like, well, you know, you could just mitigate some of that by adding the extra bit of inconvenience, and then you don't have to worry about people stealing your credit card and, you know, locking you out of your accounts.
Yeah, I did a very long time back in my call center days. I was dealing with a particular customer who they'd had their credit card compromised, and so they needed to update their credit card details. And the way they went about that was they emailed to the support email saying, I'm currently traveling through China. I don't have mobile reception, but I've managed to get on the free Wi-Fi. I need to update my credit card details. Here's my credit card number and expiry date. And I was like, wow, it's shocking that your credit card got compromised if you're just sending the details in plain text through email on free Wi-Fi in China. But, you know, she didn't know any better. And that was an opportunity to talk through what the actual issues are with what she was doing. And, you know, we can do things like, you know, extend invoices so that your account isn't charged in the meantime, and then you can update your credit card once you're back in Australia on the phone in a bit more of a secure manner. So, you know, a lot of the times we'll look at those kinds of things and we'll go, man, what an idiot. Why would they do that? But they weren't trying to, you know, compromise their credit card. They just didn't want their account to get suspended. And, you know, you can't really blame them because no one's ever sat them down and talked through why that might've been a bad idea. So that's an opportunity to actually do that. You know, I mean, I personally have just started learning to knit. And I was in my knitting class last week. And we started up a conversation about multi-factor authentication. I'm that annoying person who will bring it up in conversation. But, you know, a lot of the people in that class were, you know, a bit older. They didn't really think about these kinds of things. And the technology isn't something that they, you know, have kept up with over the years, because 70 years of technology is just too much. You know, I'm starting to get tired and I'm only 33. So yeah, just having that conversation to actually explain why something is a good idea and what it will actually help prevent to stop is really great. And I think more people need to take the time to do that, both, you know, in professional environments and in personal environments as well.
Yeah.
Because it's all the same concepts. It's just how we actually apply them.
It is. Yeah. Pretty much just being a bit more aware about what we're doing and where we're doing it. And yeah, I tend to have those conversations periodically with my clients. And yeah, in my freelance work, I get given a lot of passwords. Some of them are really rubbish. And it's like, please change your passwords for the love of God. Look, I'm going to change it for you and make it something really annoying if you don't do it for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've now, it's not been that long since the seasons changed. So we're now into autumn 2021 as the new password of choice. or spring 2021 if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. So really being in the Southern Hemisphere is a security control, because it means, you know, our default passwords are going to be slightly different.
Exactly. It's going to be much easier. I remember seeing statistically the most common password is monkey. I don't know if that's still the case now that everyone knows that.
Yeah, I've seen every year they'll publish lists of like the most common passwords. And there's always like, there's usually dragon up there somewhere.
Yes.
And I've seen people try to do like psychoanalysis as to why people would choose dragon. I was talking about how like, oh, you know, a dragon is like a strong, powerful beast and people use it because they think that strength will protect their account. And I was like, maybe they just watch a lot of Game of Thrones, like, or they think dragons are cool. Like, I think we might be overthinking it.
Yeah, but I think kind of Occam's razor. I think we need to kind of, you know, just accept that maybe they just really like dragons because they're cool, or they just like monkey because monkeys are silly and who would think of monkey?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite is using positive affirmations as a password. So, you know, you get onto your work computer and you type in, you are doing a great job, to log in. It just sets you up for a nice positive day.
Love it. Just get that mindset. It's all very subliminal right there.
Yeah, I think it's great.
That's so cool. So getting back on track. So with with your background in social sciences, how has that informed the work that you do? Because you mentioned that, you know, this is a thing that people have brought up in the past about, your entry into this space.
Yeah, I get asked a lot about it, particularly because, you know, I've worked places and with people who've kind of said, oh, you know, having a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Social Science, like it doesn't actually provide you with anything that's relevant to this job. And they're like, oh, you know, you'd be better off having a Bachelor of Computing or something like that. And for me, like, I understand that, yeah, I came into the technical field a little bit later. There's a bit of catch up to do there, which is something that I do. I do a lot of study in my spare time as well, as I think pretty much everyone in tech does, to keep on top of everything. But for me, you know, the real distinction was, you know, the things that my degree taught me, I actually use every day in my job. You know, there was a real focus on, you know, research and information gathering, and being able to pull together information from everywhere to come up with, you know, a cohesive view of a particular topic or something like that, and then being able to kind of assess the information that you've pulled together, so work out what's reliable and what's not reliable, which is probably a skill that I think a few more people these days need to have, and then being able to work through all of that information to form a particular point of view, and actually make an argument of what you think should happen or how you think things should be. And that's pretty much what I do every day, doing risk assessments and working in governance. You know, it's my job to pull together all of the information, look at it, pinpoint some of the things that are wrong, and, like, you know, find out what the risks actually are, explain why that's actually a concern, you know, what will actually happen if that thing goes wrong. And then actually work through and communicate what we need to do to fix those, how we can do that, how much time it's going to take, and just being able to communicate that clearly to basically anyone and everyone in an organization. So I'll deal with people from the CEO down to help desk. And I need to be able to communicate with all of those people in the way that they're going to understand. You know, a help desk technician is probably going to want the technical detail step by step of what needs to happen. A CEO is not going to care about what to click where and that kind of thing. They just want to know, you know, why do I actually bother about this? What benefit is it going to bring me? And it's being able to adjust the information you're providing based on your audience and what they're looking for, and being able to understand the best way to present that, because different people in different teams have different motivations, and hooking into those is going to make your life so much easier. And that's all of the things that I was learning when I was at university. You know, we were studying all kinds of things. You know, I did a unit on Middle Eastern history. I did units on, you know, the geopolitics of the Asia Pacific region. But all of that information was just around learning those same skills. And those are skills that I use every day. And I think genuinely one of the things that cybersecurity as an industry is missing, and this probably goes for tech more broadly as well, is a lot of those communication and, you know, the psychology of dealing with people and hooking into motivations. I think we're missing that, particularly in cybersecurity. I mean, if you think about it, cybersecurity as an industry is fairly new. And we're still fighting for a seat at the table in a lot of organizations. It's just now starting to become a thing that, hey, maybe we should do some of that cyber stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of that's on the people, us in the industry, for not necessarily communicating what we are actually interested in and why it's important in the best way, because we kind of, being in our little tech bubble, we're not necessarily thinking about the business speak and what the business as a whole is actually trying to do. Yeah. And if we don't buy into that, then we're not going to get much sway around why what we're doing is important, because we're just going to end up being a bit of a money sink, because cybersecurity doesn't tend to make money. We just tend to spend it. So
yeah,
being able to actually justify that is going to get you way further than just being like, dollars, please.
Yes. Yeah. And because it's such an, it's a part that permeates all aspects of the business. It's just kind of underneath. So you don't realize that everything that you do does involve a lot of these sort of concerns and these kind of considerations. So, you know, people take it for granted, basically. And, you know, it is one of those things where, you know, people go, oh, it's a thing that just happens.
Yeah. And, you know, just like all good IT, if it's good, you won't even notice. It just works. But it's when it doesn't work, or when, you know, there's something a little bit more annoying that you have to do, that people actually start to notice it. And that's when you need to do the justification piece, right? If you're going to make everyone, you know, get the code off their phone to log into something, you better have a good reason to explain to them. And yeah, there is a good reason, but if you can't get that across, you're not going to get the buy-in and people aren't going to want to do it. So that to me is the most important part, is actually getting that buy-in, because otherwise people will find every way to get around you and to not talk to you. And the people, you know, I mean, I'm kind of doing this thing, which I hate that people in cybersecurity do, which is we talk about ourselves as if we're separate from the business, but we are part of the business. Like, that's what we do. But it's kind of like, yeah, if you don't get them on board, they're not going to come and talk to you. And, you know, these are all of the users out there in the tech environment, they're the ones that are going to see when something goes wrong. Yeah. Because you can't have eyes everywhere at all times. So they're the ones that are going to see when something goes wrong. And if they don't come to you and mention it, you're missing a trick. It was one of the things that I liked most when I was in the cybersecurity role at the internet service provider, was because I'd come through the call center and I'd worked with a bunch of different people. People in the call center would actually come to me with questions about, oh, you know, this customer has called asking about this. I think there's a privacy angle to this, or, you know, I think there's an issue. And I would actually be able to help them through that. And if they hadn't known me from being in the call center, they wouldn't have known who to talk to, and they wouldn't have gotten that guidance. And then they wouldn't be able to share that guidance with other people as well. So just being visible and knowing people is so valuable in a cybersecurity role, because you will get that information from the people who are out there doing the stuff that you want done securely, but you're not the one actually doing it yourself.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's because they know it's a thing, but they don't know who to address it with. And
yeah. And once they know, they'll ask. Like, it's great.
Exactly. It's fantastic. And yeah, again, because coming up from tech support, because I did that too. And because you're in that space and you are kind of frontline right there, you are aware of those issues. So when you start to move out there are the other areas, you know, your customer support friends said, don't forget us when you leave and become all important. But you know, they know that you're a contact there. They know that you understand what their concerns are and what their experiences are. And so you're a lot more approachable in that respect there too, because they know that you understand.
Yeah. And the upside was, because I'd worked in the call center, I knew kind of all the tricks through the billing systems that we had. So I pointed out a few things that I was like, this is maybe not the best way to do that thing, because I know how to get around it. So just having that inside knowledge is also a little bit valuable. I think, you know, it's really good for people in cybersecurity who are kind of behind the scenes to really get an understanding of what is happening on the front line, you know, actually buy into what your organization is doing. Yeah. You know, I've had conversations with people where it's like, you know, you work in the IT department or the cybersecurity department of, you know, a mining company. It's like, do you say that you work in IT or do you say that you work in mining?
Yeah.
And a lot of people, they will only identify with the IT part of it. But you work in both. You need to understand what everyone else is doing to work out how to support it properly and how to secure it properly. And just kind of getting out there and understanding what people are doing is so, so valuable.
It is, absolutely. So, yeah, we've talked a bit about multi-factor authentication, and we've talked about security through PCI DSS for payment security and, you know, network security. What are some of the other considerations that, you know, businesses need to have in terms of cybersecurity and, yeah, just general protection in that space?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on where you actually are. You know, the guidance for a large organization with a dedicated IT team and a dedicated cybersecurity team is always going to be different to a small business that has 10 people total. And, you know, the IT setup is done by the owner's son on the weekends when he's got a bit of spare time. So, you know, the guidance is always different. I think a lot of the time we don't focus on the small players, and I think they're the ones that need kind of the most help, because, you know, one cybersecurity incident for a small business can knock them out of business completely. I mean, particularly with COVID and everything, you know, profit margins are razor thin. Everyone's kind of struggling. So, you know, for those kind of couple of people in a shop kind of operations, I would definitely be looking at, you know, making sure you have multi-factor authentication and just kind of maybe have a password manager to use. And just kind of be a bit careful with what information you're sending, you know, look at your actual accounts. So make sure your email accounts are particularly, you know, secure, because that's probably your main way to do business. And just making sure that that's protected, because that will be a relatively, hopefully, easy exercise, but it will save a lot of pain. For bigger organizations, it becomes a lot more complex and you kind of need whole programs of work. And these are the ones that will end up, you know, working with particular standards. So you'll end up aligning to ISO 27001, which is how you set up a whole governance system to manage your cybersecurity. Or you'll have, you know, industry specific ones. So PCI DSS applies to any business that processes credit card payments. There's also one specifically around, you know, operational technology. So that's kind of anything that's doing physical processes. So in manufacturing or mining, where you have, you know, automated, you know, robot arms doing stuff or automated drills. There's particular standards for that. Those are the ones that the big organizations will tend to gravitate towards and kind of set up a whole program. But for the smaller players, it's that basic stuff of multi-factor authentication, password managers, and maybe just, you know, get someone to look over your computer and have antivirus installed and that kind of thing. And, you know, being a bit vigilant with the emails that you receive so that, you know, you're not clicking on phishing links and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, That's cool. Have you done any stuff with social engineering? Because I always love that part.
I've done a little bit, so I've kind of dabbled. It's a bit of a kind of a pet interest of mine. I've done a couple of presentations on kind of intro to social engineering. It's not really used, like particularly in Perth, it's not, a lot of penetration tests won't necessarily have a social engineering component beyond, phishing, or maybe someone will rock up to the office and see if they can get inside, but they don't kind of do the full red team, like break in, plant software and see what you can do kinds of things too much. But I always find it really fascinating. And to me, like, I know it's a bit fancy, we call it, social engineering, but it's really just manipulating people. And everyone does it in their jobs most of the time. That's what consultants do. That's what advertisers do. Honestly, it's what I do, trying to get people to get on board with the cybersecurity program and start doing things. It's all about influencing. And then the number one kind of skill that you need is the ability to read a room or read a person and work out what approach is actually going to work here. Some people will respond well if you put on a bit of airs of authority and just kind of tell them what's happening. Some people will just kind of go, yeah, sounds good. Off they go. Other people, not so much. Other times it's, hey, can you help me with something? Let's see what we can do. It's that kind of camaraderie and, appeal to help that will motivate people. And it's just kind of working that out. So social engineering, often a bit more nefarious if you're trying to do a red team exercise. There's some really cool videos from DEF CON, if people want to look it up, where because they actually have, so in cybersecurity, we often have capture the flag competitions, which is basically let's see who can hack the most stuff to get points. And it's all set up specifically for that. No one's actually breaking any laws to do it. But it's just a way for people to keep sharp and learn new technologies and new tools. And at DEF CON, they actually do a social engineering CTF challenge as well. And there's some really cool videos of people. Rachel Toback in particular is one who, there's some really cool videos of her where she can, like, she breaks into an account with the account holder's permission, by, like, she calls up the call center and she pretends to be his partner. And she's got a baby crying in the back, like a recording of a baby crying in the background. And, she just starts crying on the phone to be like, oh, we're trying to buy this house and, like, we need to settle today. And if I can't sort this out, and then, like, the baby's crying. And, obviously the person on the other end of the phone quite naturally just kind of goes out of their way to do what they can to help her. And she manages to take over this guy's entire account and then add a password on it so he can't even get into it again. And it's really fun to watch. Like, it's a little bit scary, but it's really fun to watch. So yeah, if you look up, I think Rachel Toback, there's some really cool videos of her doing her thing.
That's very, very cool. But yeah, those adding those extra stress factors, so you're coming across as frazzled, the person takes on some of that energy as well, and then they want to help you because people just want to help each other.
And then adding that sense of urgency as well, because if you put
You
people
add
under a
that
little bit
time
of
frame.
pressure with urgency, they kind of, you suspend a lot of your logical thinking and you just go into, oh my God, we have to get this done. And that's why, 80% of phishing emails that you see, not a real statistic, just one off the top of my head, but a lot of the phishing emails that you see will include something like, if you don't do this within 24 hours, your account will be locked, or you'll be arrested or something. They use that sense of urgency to get in your head and make you stop actually thinking about what needs to be done and logically assessing it. And instead you just go, oh my God, I've got to get this done. And you will click that link. And it's just the way that our brains are wired. And it's quite an effective approach.
And it's why it works in marketing as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Call now in the next 10 minutes or you'll miss out on those steak knives.
Exactly. So yeah, it's all those sorts of strategies that are about social and, your psychological manipulation. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a fun field.
It's fun and a little scary, and sometimes it gets a little creepy. Like, I don't know about other people, but when I think about social, like, I don't think I could actually be a social engineer and like try to like force my way into a building, because I would just feel bad. I just like, I think it's nice that people's like response to things is to try to help, and I'm like, yes. I don't want to stamp that.
I don't want to be evil.
Yeah, and I don't want other people to think twice about being nice. So you know, I do a lot of cybersecurity awareness work where I am now. It's one of the favorite parts of my job, because I just get to often be a little bit silly to get a message across. And you know, what we encourage people to do is, yes, definitely help people when they need it. Just take the 30 seconds to stop and think about, you know, who's asking, why are they asking, and what are they asking you to do? Take that 30 seconds, ignore the sense of urgency. If you take an extra 5 minutes to validate a request and that stops you losing $5 million, that's 5 minutes well spent, you know?
Yeah.
So just kind of resisting some of those urges, and then, you know, thinking it through before actually being nice, because you shouldn't not be nice.
Yes. It's a tough one, because that's not how a lot of people are wired, and it makes them easy marks, not because they're stupid, but because they're kind.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's human nature, and you know, all of us would fall for a phishing email in the right context. You know, if you're under the pump with work and you get an email that you're just checking really quickly, you might be more vulnerable to clicking on it than if, you know, you were having a really chill day and you were sitting there. And things like, you know, exactly, you can think about it, you're a bit more chill. And often phishing emails, you know, if you send out a million of them, 900,000 people might look at it and go, that's not relevant to me at all. But statistically speaking, you're bound to get someone who it is relevant to. You know, yeah. One of the things that I saw a while ago was phishing emails that were going out saying, and they were going out in Australia, saying you haven't filed your US taxes. You need to click this link and fill in this form to actually file your US taxes. And I did it. I looked at it and I was like, that's dumb. We're in Australia. Who would fall for that? I then learned that US citizens, even when they're outside of the country, have to file their taxes.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, okay. If I was an American living in Australia and I got that email, it would probably be relevant to me, and yes, I might actually click it. You know, they're not stupid. It's just the situation has come together. You know, the stars have aligned and that particular email is relevant to them. It looks legit, so they click on it.
Yeah.
It's human nature. It happens. It's not something that we're ever going to 100% stamp out.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that they bank on, right? So it's a spray and pray. So, you know, they'll send out millions of these because, you know, even if they get one or two hits, that's still a payoff.
Yeah. And it doesn't take that much time and energy to send them off. So, you know, for that little amount of energy, if you get anything back, you're kind of the head of the game. Exactly. And then you get into more of the targeted, you know, the spear phishing and the whaling attacks, where you're targeting, you know, higher ups within an organization. And that takes a little bit more effort, because you have to actually do some research and, you know, work out who does what. Fortunately, LinkedIn is there with a lot of information that you can use for these kinds of things. And those take more time and take more energy, but because they are targeted, you're more likely to actually get a hit. So it's, you know, the attackers in these situations, they're also running a business and they're doing the same productivity calculations that the rest of us are doing. And it's, you know, investment versus return. And invariably they do get returns, which is, we can all kind of do what we can to stop it. But, you know, they're running businesses as well as we are. They have talented people. They have networks of people going on. Sometimes they even outsource their malware providers to malware as a service kind of networks. So they're doing all the same things we are as businesses.
Well, it is a pretty lucrative business. I mean, as a business model, it's evil, but you know, it's still an income and it's still a business that they have found that there's a niche for.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of just an ongoing battle between, I guess, each side of the conflict, and we're all just kind of hoping to stay one step ahead of each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very cool and awful at the same time.
Yeah, like a lot of things, I mean, one of the reasons I like working in cybersecurity is there's a lot of problems to solve, and
Yes.
they're quite interesting, and a lot of the time it's a bit depressing. But you know, it's kind of like, to me, it's a good thing to do, like to make the world that little bit of a better place, to make an
Yeah.
organization that little bit more secure. To me, that's a really easy way to make a positive change in the world, and that's one of the things that I enjoy about it. And it's also really interesting kind of problems to solve. And one of the things I quite like getting into is, you know, why things are happening in a particular way. You know, why is a particular organization being targeted? Who's actually targeting them? That's the stuff that I find really interesting.
Yeah.
And that hooks directly into like a lot of the stuff that I did at university. I wrote my honors thesis on the relationship between human rights violations and incidences of terrorism
Yeah.
in particular regions of China. And a lot of what I was digging into was why people do particular things, you know, what societal factors push them to take particular actions, what individual psychological factors push them to take particular actions. And that stuff directly translates into cybersecurity. I mean, until recently, I was working for, you know, one of the world's largest mining companies. And working there, you know, a lot of the stuff that we were looking at from a cybersecurity angle was to do with international
Geopolitics.
politics and, yeah, like regional politics. And, you know, you would see government announcements come out about trade wars with China, or, you know, China and Russia are fighting over something. And we would see those political changes reflected in the kinds of threats that we were dealing with. So that interrelationship between, you know, what I studied, which to most people is completely different and unrelated, and the work I was actually doing, I actually really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And it was also really fun for me because I'd done a lot of study around China specifically, and the Asia Pacific. A lot of that did feed into what I was doing because, you know, China and Australia, there's such a strong economic relationship there, and the politics is always a little bit questionable. And it will swing back and forth as to who's doing what and who thinks what's a good idea. And being able to understand those political movements really helped me in my role a lot. And, you know, I kind of got to be like, oh, hey, that particular region of China has these particular, you know, ethnic populations. And that means that the government's going to do this. And then that changes their relationship to Russia or Mongolia. And being able to draw those relationships, like I had a pretty firm grounding in that. So it was really fun to kind of think about those things in my day-to-day work, which like I never thought I would end up kind of circling back to what I studied, but I kind of did. It's just a slightly different angle, but it's all kind of relevant, really.
Oh, it is. And I mean, you look at all the stuff in, global politics and all the different governments, the Russia-America stuff, and all of that, it's cybersecurity, but it's also needing to understand about the geopolitical environment and all the kind of, ripple out effects from, any of these decisions that are being made by the various countries and various governments. And yeah, as you said, you saw that impact with resources. And it's all connected. So having that background, having an understanding of how that works, even if it's on a shallow level, gives you a better idea of the impact it has on your business and your work. So it's all very relevant.
Yeah, and it's just part of it, I guess, is just understanding what your business actually is. You know, every organization is going to have different things that they need to be concerned about. You know, that's what we were thinking about when I worked for a mining company, but you know, I've worked for other organizations, you know, that's, you know, a bank has different concerns. They've got a lot more regulatory requirements that they need to meet. There's much more oversight of what they're doing. So they're very concerned about making sure they have paper trails. And there's a lot of anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist things that they need to, you know, abide by. Whereas, you know, a different organization I worked for was in emergency services. And they're less concerned about keeping information private and more concerned about making sure that information is available to people in the field when they need it, as soon as they need it, because a lot of that information isn't actually highly sensitive, but it needs to be gotten to immediately, because if you can't find a particular address that your emergency vehicle is trying to go to, someone might die. So balancing that kind of, I guess it's adjusting the cybersecurity approach based on what your organization actually does. I mean, in cybersecurity, we talk about the CIA triad. So that's confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And for like most organizations, you're concerned about confidentiality. You want to keep your information private and protected. But that's not what all organizations need. You know, an emergency services organization, they don't really care so much about keeping their information private. They need it to be available, and they need it to have integrity. They need it to be accurate. So, and then they put confidentiality last. And it's just kind of having that flexibility to understand what the organization needs, what it values, and being able to adjust your approach based on that, because it's not, security isn't a one size fits all thing. And a lot of people will try to cookie cutter and say, well, your organization should do this. I mean, multi-factor authentication is the classic one. An emergency services organization,
there's a few seconds that they can't afford.
Exactly. If they're out in the middle of nowhere trying to find a fire or someone who's in medical danger, they're not going to pull out their phone and get a 6-digit code and enter it into a console. And to me, that makes perfect sense. That's the risk versus the reward. The balance is in the other direction. So yeah, maybe you don't necessarily need MFA there. But on the flip side, that means your accounts could be more likely to be compromised. So you don't want someone being able to get into that information and change it. So just give people read-only access. That to me is the mitigating control. Because yeah, someone can, you know, find some addresses that's probably not super sensitive. As long as they can't change them, it's probably going to be okay. And that it's that, you know, balance of everything that you need to consider when you're looking at your security controls.
Absolutely. So yeah, it's the whole authentication, authorization, and access control stuff, just trying to be able to balance that all for your needs.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'm evangelizing a little bit, but I have strong opinions on these
things. Which I think is fair, given this is the field you're in.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's okay to have opinions on like my area of expertise.
Just a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So let's see. Time-wise, I'd love to keep talking more about this, but let's move on to those other questions.
Yeah.
Cool. So what hobby or interest do you have that is most unrelated to your field of work?
Oh, interesting. I'm actually a really boring person. I spend a lot of time watching Netflix. I think if you talk to anyone in tech, they have their like backup completely non-technical career path that they like fantasize about. For me, I would like have a little hut in a forest and I would just spend my days baking and making jam. A little bit cottage core. I've recently started learning to knit, which again, a bit cottage core. but I'm actually really enjoying it. I'm like 2 weeks in, and it's just like, I'm very easily distracted. I'm always fidgeting. So having something to do with my hands, like while I'm doing other stuff is really good. And it's quite focused. And repetitive. So it's a little bit kind of like meditation. And I quite like knitted goods. So I'm looking forward to like knocking out a cardigan or a scarf or something. So that's kind of where I'm at. Yeah.
Yes. All good. I actually spoke to a surgeon, Rhea Liang, and she became Twitter famous for a bit because she was seen crocheting at a medical conference.
Well, I mean, look what happened with Tom Daly at the Olympics. He was knitting in the crowd and it went viral, and he knitted that amazing Olympics cardigan, which I love. Yes. And he actually auctions off a lot of his knitting to raise money for, I think it's a brain cancer foundation or some form of charity. So like he's not only just like being wholesome and knitting and it's delightful, he's also raising money for charitable causes, which I love. So
exactly. Perfect way to use your platform.
Exactly. Normally he's diving off them. Now he's just knitting on it. It's great.
Excellent. Perfect balance.
Exactly.
Cool. And which childhood book holds the strongest memories for you?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think Actually, so I was always a bit of a nerd. I read a lot as a kid. Probably the ones that have stuck with me are the, like, there was a whole series of books by a writer called Tamora Pierce. Yes. And she wrote a lot of like kids' fantasy books, and they had a lot of really quite strong female characters. I remember there was like Alana, the lioness, yes. And then there was the one of like the first female squire after they let girls in. And there was also there was a series of books that had four main characters, and they had like quite a strong friendship. But yeah. I really remember these books because they always had such strong female characters, and that wasn't something that I, you know, saw a lot of in books that I was reading. You know, I read a lot of fantasy and sci-fi when I was younger, and those are kind of quite male character centric, and a lot of the female characters were, you know, supporting characters at best, romantic interests and damsels in distress at worst. So for me reading those books, it was kind of whoa to be able to see like young girls who are about my age who were, you know, out there like saving the world and doing stuff like that. It was probably one of the reasons I got so into Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a teenager as well. Heroes, it was like, yeah, just, you know, teenage girls kicking ass. It was something that I really like. It was kind of mind blowing to see. And I think, you know, there's a lot more of that in media now, and I hope the kids these days are growing up with that a little bit more, and will kind of take that forward as they grow up.
Absolutely. Yeah, Tamora Pierce was one of my favorites. Like, I'd always carry one of those books with me whenever I went traveling with family. Like, it was just the thing that I had to pack. It didn't matter if I'd read it like 6 million times. It always came with me.
Yeah. I think I've actually got some on the bookshelf behind me. I think there's a couple of Tamora Pierce books. Like, I know I'm in my 30s now, but they're still there. Like, yes. Maybe I'll revisit them.
Absolutely. And, you know, I saw relatively recently, by recently, it could be any time in the last 2 years. I think it's been greenlit for being made into an actual series.
Oh, really?
I don't know which part. Yeah, so they're actually doing the Tortal universe. I don't know which books. I haven't kept up to date. But I saw an announcement saying that they've actually bought the rights to Tortal, and they're going to be making stuff out of it. It's like, yes! Because everyone's been waiting for her to actually agree to allow someone to have it. And I think they were saying that one of the issues that she had with people wanting to produce it was they might want one book, not make the rest, and then the license would be tied up forever and she couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah.
So clearly something's changed. And, you know, she's now said, yes, you may do this. So I'm really looking forward to that. I don't know which one.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, hopefully they do it well. I mean, there was a lot of excitement for the Wizard of Earthsea series from Ursula Le Guin being made into a TV show, and then it was, I haven't actually watched it, but I've heard that it's trash.
Was that recent? Because I haven't paid attention to that one.
Oh, it's been in the last couple of years, but I know Ursula Le Guin really had a go at it because they completely whitewashed it because Ged, the main character, is, you know, supposed to be, I believe it's based on Native American culture a little bit. But yeah, he was supposed to be quite dark. He, like, you know, there was this whole thing about his race that was actually relevant to his character. And they kind of just made him a white boy in the TV series. Everyone was white. Whereas I think the actual Earthsea lands were a bit more like the actual original ones where Ged was, they were quite supposed to be a darker people. It was the other lands where they had, you know, the blonde-haired, blue-eyes, pale folks. So to take that land and make it all white and all blonde was not great in Ursula Le Guin's eyes. So
fair enough.
Yeah, a lot of backlash on that. So I haven't actually watched it, but yeah. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, it's been kind of hit and miss with a lot of the book-based series lately, but, you know, a lot of people seem really happy with Shadow and Bone. That seemed pretty good, actually.
I haven't read them, but I loved the TV series. It was really fun.
Pretty good.
I watched it with a friend of mine who has read the books, and they said it was a really good adaptation. So secondhand opinion that it was well done.
Awesome. That's good to know. But yeah, so hopefully do something good with it. Don't know.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. And lastly, what advice would you give someone who would like to do what you do, and what advice should they ignore?
I mean, I think I'll start with the advice that they should ignore. I think a lot of people put out this idea that to be in cybersecurity, you have to live and breathe it and you can never think or do anything else. And I think that's really bad advice. I think pushing people to only think and study and talk about their work is a recipe for burnout. I think there's nothing wrong with going home at the end of the day and turning off your computer and not thinking about cybersecurity. I mean, I have this rule where I don't actually watch documentaries that come out about cybersecurity topics. You know, there's ones that come out about Cambridge Analytica and stuff like that. I don't watch them because that's my personal time. I need to switch off. It's probably just going to make me mad. So yes, there is definitely an element that you need to keep on top of things and you need to keep up to date, and that's a lot of work, but don't have that be the only thing that you do. Have a balance, and don't let anyone tell you that just because you don't go home at night and play Hack the Box every night that you're not going to make it, because that's to me is a very unhealthy attitude. And you might get into the industry and you might do well, but you're probably going to burn out within 5 years and you're not going to want to come back. So that's the advice to avoid. I think for people who do want to get into cybersecurity, I think getting involved in the community is a really good step. You know, there's a lot of people in cybersecurity who we all recognize that there is a bit of a shortage of people in our industry. And we're always happy to kind of help people get across what they need to kind of come in. And I think even if you don't have the traditional background that people might expect, if it's something that you're interested in, you should definitely, you know, start poking around and asking people about it, because I think we do have a need for different backgrounds and, you know, different kind of skills to come into the industry to help us build it to where it needs to be. You know, people with communication skills and, you know, people skills and, you know, who can do analytics and, you know, present topics and who can do the business side of things as well. We need a lot more of that to help us get the buy-in from the business and to actually kind of accomplish what we're setting out to do to make our organization secure. So yeah, my advice is to just get involved, get along to some networking events, start, like, there's so much on Twitter for cybersecurity. Like, there's this whole bubble of cybersecurity Twitter that you can get into and you can follow. There are people who are huge, like, celebrities within cybersecurity and you can follow them and interact with them and they will talk to you and they're great. You know, there's Hacks for Pancakes does a lot of stuff with operational technology on Twitter. She's got a lot of really cool stuff to say. There's Tanya Janker who does application security. I think her Twitter handle is SheHacksPurple. She's got a lot of stuff to do. There's all kinds of people who will help you. You can follow Swift on Security for really weird security memes. There's so much out there and people are more than happy to help. So just start clicking about and, you know, you'll find some stuff and someone will help you with the rest.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just get involved, get knowing all the people and the community and yeah, just get into it. Very cool. Good advice. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kyra, for speaking with us today. It's been absolutely amazing hearing about your work, your journey, and all the cool stuff that goes on in cybersecurity. So if you would like to know more about what you do, where can they go?
So as I said, there's a whole bunch of stuff on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Intrepid Rainbow. If anyone wants to follow me, I'm happy to send more specific requests. There's training available through ISC Squared and SANS organizations. There's also, if you're more interested in penetration testing, there's, you know, Hack the Box and a lot of CTFs out there. So it depends where you want to go. But if you start clicking around on Twitter, you'll find lists upon lists of people to follow and organizations to follow. And I'm happy to kind of point people in the right direction if they want to know it. So.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, so cool. Thank you again. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you, and I hope you have an amazing day.
Thank you, you too.
Thanks. Cybersecurity is a fascinating field, and I could happily talk about this for hours, so I really appreciate being able to speak with Kyra about her passion for cybersecurity and what that involves. To learn more about Kyra and what we discuss in the show, or to connect with us, please visit the Steampowered website at steampoweredshow.com. You can also find out more about Kyra on Twitter at Intrepid Rainbow, the link for which will be in the show notes. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to hear more like it, subscribe to this podcast and share this with your geeky or geek curious friends. You can also support Steampowered on Patreon and Ko-fi under Steampowered Show, the links for which will also be in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.